that it would be untrue. You know that I would be a liar if I was to say it to you. Girl, we couldn't get much higher. Come on, baby, light my fire. Come on, baby, light my fire.
One of the iconic classic rock bands of the 60s and first couple of years of the 70s, The Doors, which leads us into my next guest, Tom Brokaw, who you know from his years as the anchorman of the NBC Nightly News, the man who dubbed the World War II generation the greatest generation, and who now has a book called Boom, Voices of the 60s, which I guess could be called Son of the Greatest Generation. Tom, welcome to KMOX.
Sons and daughters of the greatest generation,
yeah,
actually, is what happened after the greatest generation when we had the boomers come along in the 60s. It did give rise to feminism in this country and a greater recognition of women's rights, say nothing of taking on the long overdue issue of racial equality in America and attacking segregation head on. So it was a very vibrant time.
And I said late 60s, early 70s for The Doors because you don't define the decades by that chronological decade of 1960 to 1969, 1970 to 79. You say the 60s has a different definition.
They really began, for me at least, and I think more and more people will agree with this, is that the 60s began in 1963 when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. He was the first member of his generation to become the president of the United States, the World War II generation. He was a stylish, youthful man. He seemed to have such promise to this country, however they felt about him politically. And then suddenly he was cruelly murdered in the streets of Dallas. And it set off not only a period of great national mourning, but a period of great national uncertainty, and it triggered a series of events. Lyndon Johnson became the president, got us deeper in Vietnam, had to step down because of the pressures on him. Richard Nixon arose from the political dead to become elected president of the United States. Dr. King was assassinated. The president's brother, Bobby Kennedy, decided to run for that high office. He was murdered in Los Angeles. Stop and think about all that was going on at that time. It was a very convulsive period in our lives, and yet we emerged from it with great gains in terms of civil rights and women's rights, the ability of young people to go off and have the lives that they would like to have, not what their parents would like them to have. So it was, I think, a very important period in our lives, and it's worth going back and looking at it again and saying, what did we learn from this?
You have dedicated the book to several people, including two of the ones you just mentioned, RFK and MLK, Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King. Tell me about the role they played in the career of a young Tom Brokaw. You were in your 20s and covering these guys in the 60s, right?
I was. And Dr. King, I think, 1,000 years from now, will be considered one of our most important historic figures for what he launched in this country, which was nothing less than a moral crusade. And he did it in a nonviolent fashion. He confronted with great personal courage and eloquence the segregation in this country, North and South, for that matter, and made us finally come face to face with our hypocrisy about all men are created equal, with the way black people were treated, especially in the South, but also in the northern urban areas, St. Louis, East St. Louis. You know what was going on there in terms of discrimination and the difficult times. And then Bobby Kennedy was one of the most interesting political figures I ever covered. When I first encountered him, he was the enforcer for his brother, the ruthless younger brother, who had been very conservative politically earlier in his career, sympathetic to Joe McCarthy, who'd been a family friend, the great labor racketeering, busting lawyer. And then in the 1968 campaign, you saw the evolution of Bobby Kennedy's. He began to speak out about social injustice and racial injustice, but say as well to the children of privilege on college campuses, how many of you have student deferments? And when almost every hand would go up, he'd say, that's wrong, because as you're protected by the university and by your privilege, young people from the ghetto are going to Vietnam, and that's just not an appropriate way for this society to go forward.
I know you were based in Atlanta for a while. Did you get to see King on his home turf there?
I did. I had the privilege of hearing him preach one Sunday. I saw him several times, but I heard him preach one Sunday in Ebenezer Baptist Church. Now, what people don't remember necessarily now is that that was the turf of his father, Daddy King, who was the great patriarch in the Atlanta black community. And Daddy King was known to lean forward when his son would begin to soar with his oratory and say, "Keep it simple, son, keep it simple." And I sat up in the balcony because I was not a regular parishioner, and I was spellbound by seeing this historic figure talking to the parishioners of his father's church.
It's News Talk 1120 KMOX. Paul Harris talking with Tom Brokaw, whose new book is called Boom, Voices of the 60s, Personal Reflections on the 60s and Today. And, you know, Tom, you put a lot of emphasis on the year 1968. It was the year that Bobby and Martin were both shot down. And it was also a year that several things were all coalescing at the same time. And I wonder if you see any parallels between that presidential election and the one we're going to have 1 year from now.
Well, I hope that it won't be nearly as violent or as convulsive, because that was the year of the Tet Offensive. Can you imagine if Al-Qaeda were to invade the Green Zone and invade the American embassy, which is what happened with the Tet Offensive? In pure military terms, it was not a defeat for the United States forces, but in psychological terms, it was a huge victory for the Viet Cong, and it began to make people have deep second thoughts about the wisdom of this war. So you'll have, my guess is that that won't happen, although you never know in Iraq. At the same time, you have a much more unified Democratic Party now than you had in those days. It was deeply divided between those who supported the war in Vietnam and those who opposed it, primarily the young people. You had the rise of the counterculture, in which young folks especially were saying, America sucks, you know, this is a terrible country. Many of them were running to Canada to avoid the draft. So I don't think we'll have that kind of trauma. At the same time, we will have an election in which there are very sharp differences between the Republicans and the Democrats once again. And we'll have a generational election, because all but Barack Obama are baby boomers, or people from that time, both Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
And the issues are huge this time around. I've been going around the country saying, I don't care if you're Republican or Democrat, this is one you want to get involved in. This is going to be the Super Bowl of elections in the last 50 years, because the stakes are so high and the issues have such magnitude.
You know, you mentioned something that I was thinking as I was reading through your book. The greatest generation begat the 60s generation that you write about here. But that 60s generation didn't begat, but actually became the leadership that we have today and have had for the 90s and the 21st century thus far, both politically and in the corporate world as well. And do you see the effect of that 60s mentality, if there was such a thing?
I do. The 60s mentality was much more entrepreneurial. When I was coming of age in the late 1950s and the early part of the 1960s, the expectations were, as you graduated from college, is that you would put on a coat and tie and go to get in line somewhere at the back of the line and try to work your way up in a paternalistic corporation. One of the reasons I chose journalism is that it wasn't as straight-laced as a lot of my friends were going to work for IBM, for example, or they were going to work for big banks, and they were or big advertising agencies, and they had little tiny cubicles and not much power. Journalism gave you much more freedom, I thought, and I was thrilled to have that. A lot of my friends were very skeptical about my choice. You're hearing my dogs in the background. That's what happens when you have two Labradors that you live with.
That's all right. You know, I was thinking as I was reading the book, Tom, you called it Boom. I don't think you were specifically speaking about the baby boom, but rather about the explosive impact that all these different things had on America in the 60s.
It was a combination of the two. It was a play on boomers, and then the boom, one of the ways I describe it, I say, you know, if you want to get a perspective on the 60s, let me just give you one small example. You're a World War II veteran. You've gotten a good job at an auto factory, and you've got a pension coming, and for the first time your family can think about sending a child to college, and you bought a new car last year. You're crew cut, and you belong to the American Legion. You come home one night and sit down for what they called supper, and you look across the table, and there's your daughter with some scrawny guy with hair down to his shoulders. They're holding hands, and she says, "Daddy, we're going to move in together, but don't worry about it. I'm on the pill." She's not wearing a bra, and sitting next to her boyfriend is your son, wearing a T-shirt made of an American flag with a swastika over it, and he's telling his dad how he can get out of the draft, and if he can't get out of the draft, he's moving to Canada. It was that kind of a jarring transition that this country was going through, and so I say, boom.
And what about the impact on women like, well, frankly, your wife, Meredith? I mean, the women's lib movement was a huge part of the 60s as well.
Yes, it was. And I was, you know, I was about to say that the mother in that household, who was out in the kitchen, had been doing the cooking the dinner that night, was beginning to think in new ways about what her life should be or what her daughter's life could be because of the feminine mystique and the rise of women's rights and the possibilities that women could band together and be a real political force in this country, which they became. And now we have a woman running for president of the United States.
Yeah, and you know, this is the first time, really, that a girl can be told, you too could grow up to be president of the United States. We haven't had a woman elected president yet, and we may not next year, but the fact that she may become the nominee of a major party in this country is a long way from 1962, when your wife would be told, well, you're a young bride, you don't work.
No, and you don't work because you may get pregnant, honey, and we don't want to. And here I have this really bright, gifted woman to whom I was married, who had a much better college record than I did, went on to, you know, organize a chain of toy stores in New York and serve on the corporate board of Gannett and be the vice chairman of a big international environmental organization, write books for kids and write books about Montana and her horseback riding. And in those days, she was turned away everywhere she went until she finally got a job as a school teacher.
In the book, you talk to a lot of people, some friends, some professional colleagues, some who you may not have known before. But I'm particularly interested in the story of your colleague, Jane Pauley, who, of course, grew up in the 60s and then exploded onto TV in the 70s and worked with you on the Today Show. Did she find a lot of those same obstacles in her life?
No, she, and for Jane, as she describes it, was quite the opposite. She won the lottery, so to speak. She was in the right place at the right time. She was a young woman from Indianapolis, graduated from college in 1968. Obviously, I had a great presence and oratorical skills, so she got involved in television news. She was doing the weekend show in Indianapolis, but didn't have any aspiration to become a network correspondent or anything. She was trying to figure out what she was going to do with her life when she gets picked out of Indianapolis and is made the co-anchor of Floyd Kelber, who was a legendary local anchorman in Chicago. After about 9 months, that didn't work too well in the ratings. We were looking for a co-host for the Today Show. I was the chief correspondent, and Jane had all this poise. She was young. She was attractive. She was articulate. She goes to New York to sit beside me on the Today Show. And on her opening day, she said, perhaps you're wondering what I'm doing here. Perhaps I am too.
Yeah. And turned into a pretty good career for herself.
A great career and a great personal life. She married Gary Trudeau. I'm happy to report they met at our dining room table. My wife was the matchmaker in that case. They have a wonderful marriage, three terrific children, and Jane describes, you know, what it was like to be rising through the ranks in television news when the older white males were not accustomed to having women around, didn't know what to do with them, and then she had to make some tough choices. Did she want to have babies? And if she had babies, how did she balance that against her career? And I think in some ways, even though she was famous and wealthy, she was every woman.
Yep, pretty representative of the decisions that a lot of women have had to make, not only in the 60s, but 70s, 80s, 90s, and certainly today as well.
Exactly.
Talking today with Tom Brokaw, whose new book is called Boom, Voices of the 60s, Personal Reflections on the 60s and Today. If you want to get a copy, use the link on KMOX.com, and a portion of the proceeds will go to help St. Louis Children's Hospital. Did you see your buddy Brian Williams on Saturday Night Live this weekend, Tom?
Yeah, I sure did. We talked about it before he did it, and then I was torn. As I told him, I had two reactions to it. One, I was very grateful that he did it on a night when we could turn the clock back 1 hour. I told him this in the presence of Andy Rooney. I said, so Andy could have that extra bourbon and water, and I could have an extra cup of hot milk before I go to bed. And then the other piece of it, of course, was that I said I had divided the loyalties because I was watching BC and Florida State at the same time, so I was switching back and forth.
Would you have ever done that?
No, I wouldn't have. And Brian and I talked about it. I said 10, 15 years ago, Lauren came to me a couple of times and said, would you ever think? And I said, no, I really can't, Lauren, because I think people would get confused about what role I should be playing here. I think that's changed now. I think the new generation is much better able to distinguish between what his real day job is and this weekend foray and something that, you know, he wanted to do. He's got a great sense of humor. He's been a big fan of the show for a long time, so now he's back to being an anchorman again.
Yeah, I think he pulled it off and did a good job.
Yeah, everybody thinks that, I think.
Back to the 60s and your book, Boom. Are we seeing a 60s backlash today?
Oh, I think we've been seeing one for some time. Some you know, as Bill Clinton says of Newt Gingrich, he really made a caricature of the 60s and ran against the 60s. Others did as well. Some of the wounds of the 60s were self-inflicted. The honest members of that generation talk about that, saying we let the pendulum swing way too far. We had tactics, no strategy. You know, my friend Mort Saul in California said to me in about 1969, he said, I don't know about these kids. He said, they put a Gene McCarthy bumper sticker on their Volkswagen and drive around for 9 months. When he doesn't get elected, they say, that's it, I'm giving up on the system. And they went away, and the conservative movement in this country organized itself, think tanks and publications, made sure that from election cycle to election cycle, they knew where their votes were and how to get them out. And the left was a little late to catch up to all that.
Yeah, well, you were talking earlier about how the 60s brought us different Democratic parties, and I don't think there has been a single Democratic Party since then.
No, there hasn't been. They've been kind of at war with themselves about the 60s. They lost the South, and it was not just the Seg South that they lost. They lost people who were more conservative, like Sam Nunn, who decided to leave the Democratic Party, but he left the Senate because, as he often said to me, I'm too conservative to be a Democrat and too smart to be a Republican.
Do you think we're seeing a little bit of that now on the Republican side, some of them who don't like being pulled so far to the right?
I do, and it's the mirror image of what the Democrats went through. There's a lot of concern in the Republican Party that they'll succumb to the same hubris that sank the Democrats in 68 and will be subject to the same kinds of divisions.
You joke that Clinton and Gingrich, the two guys you mentioned a moment ago, were separated at birth. What do you mean by that?
Well, here you think about two white boys from the South, very smart, from dysfunctional families, prematurely gray, both had real personal difficulties when it came to women, both very bright, both gabby, both loved politics. It really defined their lives, and they wound up as adversaries, just like twins who couldn't get along, one in the White House and one in the Congress of the United States. They both admire each other's political skills enormously, but of course they see the world in a different way.
One of the other people that you talk to in the book is General Colin Powell, who has such an interesting history that unfortunately is going to, I think, have this WMD thing hanging over him as his, well, the way he's remembered. But when you talk to him, he talks about everything going back to his days in Vietnam, right?
He does, and he talks about what he thought that was a more dangerous time because we had the Cold War still underway. We didn't know what was going to happen next then. And he was in Vietnam, and he said he was a major. He really wasn't paying much attention to the anti-war movement because he was just so consumed with getting his job done. There was a time when a lot of black officers, he said, were being lured out of the military service into corporate life because corporate life was much more conscious of diversity as a result of the 60s, and when they looked around, these highly trained black officers were, for them, great targets to try to get into the corporate structure. And as Powell said to me, I'm proud I stayed, and so did a lot of my fellow black officers. We stayed true to our military careers.
As we talk about the differences between then and now, one of the other things that strikes me is when you talk about the women's movement, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, all of those things that were massive parts of the 60s generation, there is no single defining social movement for the generation of the 21st century, is there?
There's about to be, I think, and I think it's probably global climate warming, global climate change. My guess is that that will be the new rallying cry, and it will attract people from the right as well as from the left. That's my guess.
But it hasn't happened yet.
No, but you do see the ramping up going on. Most of the major scientific institutions in the country are organizing themselves around how do we meet this challenge, what do we do about it. Large corporations, including General Electric, the car companies, a lot of the oil companies, they're beginning to say this is going to be the great challenge, the unifying challenge of the early part of the 21st century.
What I think is fascinating about that is when you talk about the anti-war movement of the 60s, we were never attacked then, but here we were 6 years ago, attacked on our own soil, and yet even that wasn't a rallying cry for a movement in this country either way, really.
Well, I think in part because we didn't have a draft. I hate to be so callous about it, but I think a lot of the moral passion, so-called, during the 60s dissipated when the draft went away. And people, it turns out, were looking out after their own their own well-being, as it were, more than they were about making a moral commitment on the war.
Do you think, as you look back on that decade, that there's a verdict in on the 60s yet, Tom?
No, I don't. Mrs. Clinton, Senator Clinton, had the best question to me. She said, have you cracked the code of the 60s yet? And I said, no, I really haven't. I really think it's not crackable yet. I think we're still working our way through it. I think after 2008 and that election, we'll have a better sense of whether we're going to be able to crack it.
Are you working on a TV project to go with this?
I am, for the History Channel. We're doing 2 hours on December 9th. And we've got some people in there that are not in the book, like Bruce Springsteen, for example, and some others who went through that time. Bruce was just an 18-year-old. I went out to Chicago to visit him the other day, and he said what the 60s said to him as the son we know is personal history. His dad was a pretty hard case, a guy who drank beer at night and worked in the factories and wanted his son to get a haircut. And he said what the 60s said to me was that I could be who I wanted to be, not what my father wanted to be.
Now, you can't talk about that generation without talking about the great music that came out of it. And I think as much as any other, or maybe more than any other, a sense of music that really meant something that still resonates today.
I suppose if there is a consensus about the 60s, it is that the music was fantastic. And James Taylor and Paul Simon I talked to, Kris Kristofferson. I know Neil Young is doing this as he goes around the country as well. These guys take an acoustical guitar and go sit on a stool, and they can pack an arena anywhere because people just want to hear those songs again.
Yep, and still continue to write songs that, again, have meaning to them.
That's true.
The book is called Boom, Voices of the 60s, Personal Reflections on the 60s and Today. Tom Brokaw, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Bob.
If you'd like to get the book, by the way, you can order it through KMOX.com, click on our bookstore, and if you buy it that way, a portion of the proceeds will go to help out St. Louis Children's Hospital. Tom Brokaw here on the Paul Harris Show on News Talk 1120 KMOX.